Welcome to the Cop Doc Podcast. This podcast explores police leadership issues and innovative ideas. The Cop Doc shares thoughts and ideas as he talks with leaders in policing, communities, academia, and other government agencies. And now, please join Dr. Steve Morreale and industry thought leaders as they share their insights and experience on the Cop Doc Podcast.
Hello, everybody. We've got Dr. Sarah Abbott, a professor, an associate professor from LaSalle College here in Massachusetts. And today we're going to be talking about her program, something she started and grew, a jail diversion program. So I wanted to say good morning to you, Sarah, and please introduce yourself to the audience.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here today. My name is Sarah Abbott, and I'm originally from the UK, and I emigrated to the US some 28 years ago to seek adventure. And boy, did I find it. So I'm a transplant. I came here for opportunity, for education, and to live a life that I wasn't able to have in Leeds at the time. So when I got here, I became a social worker. My social work training started in the UK, and I was a social worker with folks with mental health concerns in a young adult residential program. I progressed through my master's degree. I got a master's in CJ from UMass Lowell, and then eventually went forward and got my doctorate from Northeastern University in their Law, Policy, and Society program. Along the way, I did work for a crisis team at Advocates in Framingham, and my journey with jail diversion started in 2002. At that time, then Deputy Chief Craig Davis of the Framingham Police Department approached Advocates with the brilliant idea of embedding a master's level social worker into the department. This was a program that had not been done anywhere that we could find, and took the idea of collaboration with mental health organizations to a whole new level.
So let me ask, you used the term jail diversion. When I first heard that myself, I thought, what the hell are they talking about? And how did you come to that? And what exactly does that mean? And for the listener, for the police chief, for the sergeants, the lieutenants, and for community leaders, try to explain what that meant. What was the intention?
Certainly. And I'm glad you asked that question. It's rather limiting, truthfully, as a concept and model now, given the growth and expansion of the work. But at the time, we tried to articulate what the goal was. And at that time, our explicit intent was to prevent individuals with mental health concerns entering the criminal justice system through law enforcement and ending up in jail. So it was that direct link that we were trying to make in this articulation of the model. Over time, it's evolved, and it was always a co-response program, but now more accurately is referred to as pre-arrest co-response program. And the concept of co-response was Craig Davis's, and he invited a social worker from Advocates, which was me, in 2003 to become a part of operations in the patrol division. I was hired due to my interest and expertise at that time in the intersection of mental health and the criminal justice system through my academic and scholarly work. And I had done a 5-year service at crisis team prior to going into the police department. So I was in the unique position of being very interested in criminal justice and being interested in crisis intervention. And it was really the meeting of those two worlds that afforded me the opportunity to be the first ride-along co-response clinician in the Commonwealth.
So had you seen, as you approached that, and as Chief Davis made the recommendation to pair you, were there other models out there that you were able to reach out for?
That's a great question. Obviously, as many police leaders will articulate, we don't like to reinvent the wheel. And Chief Davis looked and explored other models that were operating. The primary model that was operating was the Memphis, Tennessee Crisis Intervention Team model, which launched in 1989 and has been a longstanding understanding part of the way that police officers train to respond to these calls. And Chief Davis didn't feel that that was enough for him and the department that he had and the officers and the population that he wanted to address. And he felt that it would be much more beneficial to his department to incorporate training. Certainly, formal training is very important when you're launching any partnership. But he articulated the value of the informal training, which would happen when police officers ride alongside me as their partner. We'd go to hundreds, if not thousands, of calls during my time there. And they would learn from me, and I would learn from them. And it would be the perfect blend of safety and security on calls which are unpredictable and dynamic, but also the calming presence of a non-uniformed social worker whose role is intently to divert where appropriate and to de-escalate calls for service.
So you walk into somebody's office, their cruiser, for the first time. How the hell did that go? I can't imagine that that was well received at first.
You know, I have a story about that. So because this hadn't been done anywhere before, there was some natural trepidation and suspicion about me, about my role, about what I could bring to this. Not to mention I spoke funny and wasn't from around here, so I had credibility gap to breach. What I used was a sense of humor, which I have a healthy dose of, and an ability to relate to officers in terms of really trying to engage them in relationship building. And obviously that was a process. I had the distinct pleasure of being paired with a sergeant, Michael Esposito, who was a sergeant in Framingham on the 4 to 12 shift, my shift for many years. And he was a very well-respected officer and sergeant. He was the patrol sergeant, and he had and has the gift of communication. And he approached me and said, you know, let's try this, and grabbed me from dispatch where I was sitting in the corner hoping people would talk to me and at least ask me if I wanted anything for dinner, which is, you know, is an important part of the shift. And he took me out and he said, we've got this guy. And he's been calling the Framingham Police Department multiple times a week, engaging fire, rescue, EMS, police, four different sets of entities appearing on scene due to his inability to control his calling of 911. So Sergeant Esposito said, let's go to this guy's house and let's see how he's doing. And I want to see if you can figure out how we can help this and stop these calls, because it's costing the city thousands of dollars. We don't feel like we're helping him, and it's taking away resources that are needed elsewhere. So we went to this gentleman's house, and upon entry, he let us in. We, you know, I introduced myself. I'm Sarah, I'm a social worker. The Framingham Police think that you may need some help. Can we talk? And he allowed us to come in, and I observed multiple phones. This was in 2003. There were still landlines, and there were multiple phones in various stages of disrepair. There was a phone on the wall that had been removed, like forcibly, by this gentleman in order to prevent him from calling 911. And we immediately realized, and the sergeant knew, but, you know, didn't know what to call it necessarily, that this was a significant case of someone with obsessive compulsive disorder tendencies and a condition in that regard. So I was able to connect this individual who legitimately could not stop calling 911 and had tried many, many ways to regulate this behavior. I was able to get him into treatment for the first time. He was in his early 20s. He'd never seen a psychiatrist or had any mental health support. I got him into treatment. The calls stopped. And Sergeant Esposito and I would go visit him and visited him regularly. He was part of our route and we'd just go check in on him. And really, it was one of the first ways in which I knew and he knew that this was going to be a slam dunk, because this was a great frustration, a chronic repeat situation and no end in sight. So that was the first case. And he said to me, if you get this right, I'll tell everybody that you're the best thing since sliced bread and this program will be a success. But if you it up, then you're going back to England. And that was it. And I was, no pressure, right? And I felt like calling my mom and being like, oh, wow, I don't know how I'm going to do this. But it was very straightforward for me. It was a very clear referral and it worked. So it was a win-win. And after that, there was no turning back.
It sounds like he threatened to deport you even though you were a citizen.
I'm not sure say that.
So you, a couple of things that stand out. And that is that police are called to calls where in the past they have been ill-equipped to handle and that they don't have the clinical knowledge, the clinical experience, the clinical benefit of being able to speak to another clinician at a treatment center or at a hospital. How is that valued, a licensed clinician into a police situation to work in tandem? What's the benefit?
Yeah, multiple. So the first, just going back a little bit, all of the success of the program hinges on the relationship between the clinician and the officers. As you know, law enforcement has its own culture and operations, and entering that world from a mental health organization, you know, you need to learn a whole new language. So to be able to do this job well and to get the outcomes that we've achieved, the clinician has to be perfectly fit and appropriate for that department. So assuming that is in place, which it was in Framingham, the benefit to the officers was that they were able to resolve calls at the root as opposed to referring to their original three go-tos, right? Which is arrest or was arrest, take them to the hospital or kind of patch it together and leave, knowing that the next shift's probably going to end up back there, but you've got limited time. And I believe that time is the essence to the success of this. If the clinician is on scene immediately, if they're on the first response line, they are seeing, hearing, smelling, and experiencing exactly what the officer is seeing, hearing, and experiencing. We are able to translate that into an assessment, which all happens rapidly, almost in our minds, about what the needs of this individual are right now. It's not so much about what's happened to this person in their history and the, you know, any chronic long-term concerns that they have. It's like, what brought us here today and what's going to be the most effective way to resolve this so that the police don't end up back here. And more importantly, that the person gets the help that they need, which is the goal that police and social work share, is to get people the help that they need. I do not believe it's been a lack of willingness or openness to this. It has been two systems running in parallel paths, seeing very often the same people repeatedly and not being able to communicate. And what this has done is brought the resource inside. The officers grab that resource. It's theirs. It is a police resource. The police access it. They deploy it. And beautifully, if they decide that this is a law enforcement matter, they don't have to involve us. So the program is voluntary for officers to use, which is why I believe it's been so successful. It is not a specialized unit. Anybody in the department can access the clinician, detectives, dispatchers, the chief, the mayor, the patrolmen, patrolwomen, school resource officers. Anyone can access the clinician during their time in the city, and there's no access in entryway, or it's like, we need you on this call, you're on the call.
So you've got a sergeant, you've got a deputy, forward thinking. I'm not saying that officers aren't forward thinking, but until you can prove yourself to them, they're not interested, they're disinterested at first. When I hear you talk about Memphis as a model and you tell me that it's 30 years or older, and we're just hitting this a few years in some departments this year, that's crazy. You know, why did it take so long to drag this idea into the system? But as you were working with other officers and as you had the imprimatur of Sergeant Esposito, how did that happen? Did you start ending up in other cruisers? Were they still reluctant at first, trying to pick your brain to try to understand whether even they could trust you with the vouch?
You know, it's not as difficult as I imagined it be. It took less time to integrate than I expected. That said, I had to prove myself to each officer or to clusters of officers. And it's interesting that what happened was that the sergeant took a day off or worked a detail and wasn't available. So the cover of the sergeant in the beginning was very helpful, but there were opportunities then for other officers to see what I could do. And it emerged in that it wasn't full ride along all the time in his absence in the beginning. But what would happen is that I'd be in dispatch, they'd call for me on a scene. So someone would take me to a scene, then bring me back, right? So I'd be involved in the case, but not committed for the 8 hours. And then over time, they saw me as an ally. They saw me as someone who was not there to judge what they were doing. They saw me as someone who was offering suggestions and help, but not mandating it. And I feel that those are the necessary ingredients. And because of that, officers were not long to jump in. And it's interesting now, the leadership of the Framingham Police Department, the chief currently is Chief Lester Baker, and he was a patrolman on the shift that I started on. So it's institutionalized. I've been there. The department has had the program longer than most of the department members. So the initial crew that I was on with were very welcoming. And again, I believe that I was naturally inclined for this work. I love crisis work. I love seeing things unfold. I love being part of putting the puzzle together to help people. I like pressure of only having 5 minutes to do it. And so it was a natural fit. We were both type A, and whoever I partnered with quickly learned that I wasn't there to interfere or report on them to the chief or their wife even.
So I recall being at a presentation that you made, and you were talking about, again, the way it evolved, the trust that was earned over time, and the reluctance fairly soon of officers not wanting to go on calls if there was an emotional disturbed person and if the clinician wasn't there. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's testament to the way that the program evolved in that officers were seeing the value of it. One of the other pieces that really led to a propelling of credibility was my ability in the beginning and subsequent clinicians' ability to intervene in post-arrest situations. So although this is arguably a pre-arrest model, people get arrested and have mental health concerns. We do not divert violent people committing violent offenses. We do not divert domestic violence cases. There are mandatory arrest laws in existence in Massachusetts. But that does not mean that once the person has been arrested and during booking, it becomes very clear to the desk officer or the lieutenant in charge that this person is in distress. And the thought of keeping them in a cell 8x10 for a long weekend quickly became an opportunity for me to intervene. And so there was a post-arrest which helped get buy-in for the service in general, was able to interview people in custody, in the station, and get them out of there and out of the department, which was completely ill-equipped to maintain someone who was headbanging or trying to hurt themselves in custody. So those types of interventions became quite common. While I was in the station, they were like, oh, while you're here, come and see this guy. And then when I was on the road, they were calling from the station, and then I couldn't be in two places at once. And very quickly, the program grew and has grown exponentially. So current operations, there are 4 full-time staff assigned to the Framingham Police Department through advocates, and they're almost 24/7. And that is the goal of the current chief, because it's become difficult to say to day shift, you can't have this clinician. And they're saying there are multiple times a day. These calls don't stop or start at 4 p.m. or 8 a.m. And so we found the need that the more we've been embedded, the more integrated we've become, the more invaluable we are. And officers are using us. Sometimes we're looking to double up in the, you know, between 9 p.m. and midnight in Framingham, we need 2 resources available. Wow. So, yeah.
So I want to get into mental health, and I just want to set the table, mental health of officers and the things that they're involved in. But
good.
Let me back up for a moment. There's two other things that come to mind. And number one is, how do you select? Can any clinician do this? There has to be a particular training, a particular proclivity, and not all can do that. So how do you select, and how do you realize? Imagine it's hard enough to select a police officer, keep them on probation to see if they can make the cut. Is it the same, even though it's a licensed clinician?
Certainly. That's a great question, and is one of the key ingredients, as I mentioned, of the model's success, is the ability of the clinician to enter a law enforcement environment, to be completely isolated from other clinicians. Often these clinicians are the only mental health resource in the building with 135 police officers. sponsors. So they have to like that environment. They need to want to be in it. They need to be able to navigate the roles and the differentiation between law enforcement and clinician. In terms of an attitude, you need to be flexible, nimble. Every job is your job. everything they ask you to do is part of your job, as long as it's appropriate. And it always has been. And that can include, you know, a clinician that I've supervised in the past was in the department, and right outside the department, a mother overdosed in the front seat with a 5-month-old baby in the back. And the clinician's job for the next 6 hours was to care for this child, find resources while they basically try to revive the child's mom. And so that's not jail diversion, and that's the evolution. So what's happened is that because of the acumen of the clinicians, because of the right stuff, the type A, the boundaries, the ability to stay compassionate, to stay in your lane when you're surrounded by law enforcement, whose focus is often safety and security, you need to be able to really narrow in and zone in quickly on what's happening. So the ability to rapidly assess people and the confidence to say, this is what's happening. Because there is no learning curve. You can't come in and be like, hey, it's field training. I'll be ready in 4 months. Once you hit that department, especially Framingham and others who have been operational, Marlborough has been operational for over 12 years. Years, Watertown for 10 years, all those departments expect day one that the clinician's going to be able to pivot to whatever's thrown at them. So no, not every social worker wants to do this work, should be in this role.
Where does it go? Where does this program go? How did it take foot? How did it take hold? How do you do outreach to try to encourage others to get involved? I'm sure some of the chiefs are speaking about this favorably, but what has the role of advocates been for trying to push this idea forward? We're talking about the funding. You've heard that. And you talk about social workers and going out and sending them on certain calls. And of course, the police, I think a police reaction is, well, okay, good luck with that. Go out on calls without police and you'll be calling us pretty soon. So how does advocates advocate for pushing the program forward?
So we have been growing organically for 18 years. And when I say organically, we have never been in a position or wanted to be in a position where we've gone to a police department and told them that they need this. My experience in working and partnering and truly collaborating with law enforcement is that this has to be a true partnership. So law enforcement has typically initiated the inquiry. Our greatest strength is the word of mouth of our chiefs, sergeants, officers in the 15 police departments that Advocates Now has co-response programs. So when you combine, that's hundreds of police officers who know hundreds of other police officers from the academy. They go to training together. Chiefs meet regularly in task forces and chiefs meetings, and it's been word of mouth. Framingham was the first. I worked in Framingham starting in 2003. Several years after I started working there, I was in dispatch, and the Marlborough Police Department called Framingham dispatch and said, hey, do you have some social work resource or something? We've got a guy that we arrested who is reporting that he is suicidal, and we don't have the manpower, as you know, which is required to extract someone from a cell involuntarily, often put them in an ambulance or a cruiser, transport them for an evaluation. So could we borrow your clinician? Could she come here and see this guy? So dispatch turned around. I was sitting there at 8 o'clock at night. Nice summer's evening, had plans for a great party. As you know, in law enforcement, plans mean nothing. And they said, can you stop at the Marlborough PD on your way home? And I said, sure. I was fascinated by going to another department. I wanted to see how Marlborough did things. It was an opportunity to get behind the scenes, which I love to do, and interview this guy. So I stopped over there on the way home, and I did an assessment while he was in custody. And I determined that this gentleman was not at high risk of suicide, may in fact be reporting these concerns to evade police custody. And that my recommendation was, 10-minute watches, and they have a matron system in Marlborough at the time. So I put the individual on watch, and sure enough, he maintained himself till court. And they were blown away by this. They could not believe that someone would come to their department, go back into the cell block, and talk to this guy and make an assessment and have the authority and the ability to give them recommendations and take the liability off them of watching him, worrying about him. As I said, maybe having to use force to transport him. All of that was immediately relieved. They had an endorsement from an appropriate authority and he was good to go. And after that, the next day, the chief, Mark Leonard at the time, called our chief at the time and said, how do we get this? And we launched in Marlboro in 2008 with foundation funding. And we've been there 12 years. And they have currently 3 full-time people assigned to that program.
So I know that you have done some regionalization, in other words, to approach where a small department can't necessarily afford that and that you share a clinician. Talk about that so others would understand.
Sure, that's a great question. And the regional model came on board in 2015. So as I mentioned, we were in Framingham, then Marlboro, then Watertown did the same thing as Marlboro did, invited us in 2011. 2015, then Chief Davis moved from Framingham to the Ashland Police Department. Ashland is a smaller community, less officers, less calls, but a burgeoning need for mental health support. But he realized that he alone would not qualify for a grant or could not provide sufficient work for a full-time clinician. So Chief Davis invited his contiguous partners, Sherburn Police, Holliston Police, Hopkinton Police, to go in with him on a regional adaptation, which would share clinician resources in the 4 contiguous towns. The clinician would rotate coverage and be in each department rotating, but they would most importantly be available to any of the 4 towns while they're on duty, regardless of where they were sitting. So this played out that the clinician maybe on a Monday was actually physically present in Ashland. Holliston had a suicidal person on a roof. Ashland, through mutual aid agreements, which they already had in place, would transport the clinician across line, meet them at the line, more often than not, take them to the call, hand them off, drop them off. The clinician would take care of the call and Holliston would either hang on to them or bring them back. And my concern was that the relationship would be more difficult to form when covering 4 departments. And so the coverage, consistent coverage in each department each day, rotating, and the operations meetings, which happen where all stakeholders come together every month, ensured that those relationships stayed strong. Some of the departments only have 15 officers, so you could get to know them pretty quickly. And it worked. And we now have launched 3 additional regional models and for a total of 15 police departments that have co-responder clinicians available in Metro West.
That's great. So there's growth and there's hope for sure. A few questions before we begin to wind down. You've been around policing for an awful long time. You've heard the criticisms. What's your take based on your experience about the value of police, the mindset of police, and the care and concern of police for their community?
It's a great question. And one, obviously, that I think a lot about. There are many ways in which I recognize that social work and law enforcement have more in common than difference. The first day that I walked into Framingham Police, before Michael Esposito grabbed me for that call, I noticed that there was a woman who was living in the lobby. I walked by her into dispatch, introduced myself. I said, you know, who's the lady in the lobby? And they said, oh, that's so-and-so. I'm like, what's the deal? Well, she's homeless right now and it's cold. So she has to leave during the day when the brass are around. But at night, she sleeps here. And I was stunned by this. And she became someone that I've worked with for years. She has lifelong challenges. But that struck me as an absolute sign that we could do something good. Because the role of law enforcement, in my eyes, is to be guardian, to take care of the well-being and protect the most vulnerable among. And those that don't have resources tend to engage with police more. And some of the experiences, I'll tell you another story that really impressed me. It wasn't long into my career in Framingham, and we were called to a guy with a knife, right? Pretty common call in cities and some towns across the Commonwealth and beyond. Guy with a knife, not the call you want to go to. So I'm on the road, I'm in that sector, we're second on scene. And because of the concern that they had for my well-being, and because they didn't know me as well as they do now, I wasn't allowed to go into the apartment, but they let me stand outside. So I watched two officers enter the apartment. This was 2003. There were maybe five or six tasers on the whole department at the time. And the closest taser, which is what would be the preferred use of force if this knife incident goes south, is across town, 5 to 7 minutes away. Even then, we were flying across town, right? But still 5 to 7 minutes away. Framingham is 26.2 square miles. So this guy that I'm with has to hold this gentleman off or down verbally until their taser arrives, right? Because nobody, in my experience, wants to shoot anybody ever. This gentleman was 6'2". He had an enormous amount of rage, and his girlfriend had just broke up with him after telling him that the baby wasn't his. So lots and lots of anger, lots and lots of potential for escalation. The officer I was with had been riding with me on and off for maybe 4 or 5 months at this point, had seen me de-escalate people, had seen how I approached it from the get-go. So I'm standing outside the apartment. I'm nosy as heck. I'm listening to what's going on in there. And I hear the officer introduce himself to the individual in crisis. My name's Chris. I'm an officer in Framingham. You look really upset. What's going on? And that, to me, was a game changer. Not that that officer hadn't done that before, maybe hadn't done that before. I don't know. But that, to me, was different. And I heard this officer, who was a father, talk to this gentleman about how devastating this must be. Talk the gentleman, he had three knives when we got there, talk two of them out of him, and until the officer with the taser arrived and was able to de-escalate and transport him without injury to the hospital where he went inpatient. No charges were filed, no arrests were made, no summonses. There was no true crime here because it was intercepted and de-escalated. So when they all got done, when we were back in the cruise and we're driving away, I was like, my God, Chris, that was unbelievable. I said, I don't think I've ever heard an officer introduce himself in that way. It was really effective. And he's like, do you fucking think I don't listen to you? I'm sorry, Steve. All right.
That's okay. That's reality. Yeah. I'm sure that's what was said.
He said, I've been listening to you do this stuff for months. He's like, the first thing I noticed was that you said my name is Sarah, and how that humanized the interaction. This is not rocket science. Officers are willing and able to learn skills but need opportunities to understand them, to learn them, to witness them, to see them be effective, and then to internalize them. And the department is a different department because they have thousands and thousands and thousands of calls where they've jointly responded and worked in partnership and seen really great outcomes.
Well, think about, you must be very proud about where this program has taken your, what you hatched as a child has now become an adult and has taken hold and is gainfully employed, which is amazing. What's in the future for Sarah?
No, it's a great question. I do feel like all my birds have left the nest and that program is in excellent shape, has institutional knowledge, has a leadership and team. There are 15 employees in the advocates team who are amazing clinicians with great intelligence and aptitude. And I have strong belief that the program will outlive all of us. In my world, I'm pivoting to a broader and larger vision. I would like to see training and program models be developed based on data, based on evidence, and taken to the next level. I believe that we have a platform in place with excellent training. Massachusetts has one of the most professional, well-trained department, set of departments in the country, in my experience. And I've worked in other places where that's not the case. And I see us looking with an acute eye and focus on what works and what do we know works and how do we standardize and institutionalize this. Like you said, this has been slow growing. I've spent 18 years of my career building, nurturing, and fostering, replicating this work. It's time to take it to the next level. I'd like to see more work in my future engaged in the training and orientation of teams to work together in training settings. I'd like to see evidence-based practices and models take hold and be really clearly defined in Massachusetts and for the country. My experience is that police departments Americans are desperate for help and resources in this regard. And I'd like to be part of the broader picture in envisaging how we can implement the reforms available to us and how we can do that with law enforcement in mind, given that they are the people who will be both implementing these reforms and expected to adhere to them. So we want a well-prepared law enforcement force to respond with a range of opportunities from clinicians to training, simulations, academy.
So, Sarah, one of the things we talked about before we got on mic is that you're considering starting and branching out on your own. What are you trying to do?
That's right, Steve. Thank you. I am. I'm launching an LLC, Abbott Solutions for Justice. And the work of the Abbott Solutions for Justice team will be to spread the news of different models across the world. There are international partners that we'll be working with. There are national partners that I hope to engage with more, and certainly plenty of work left to do in Massachusetts. I am driven to provide law enforcement the best possible tools so that they can do their job effectively, safely, and that everybody gets to go home. That's what we know matters. And I believe that law enforcement are uniquely positioned to deliver excellent outcomes if they have the support, funding, and mentorship of other departments who have been engaged with this. So my hope is to spread the work that I've been doing in co-response and branching out to additional opportunities as they present themselves.
Well, there's no time like the present because this is a major issue. And I think having somebody with the experience that you have can be very beneficial. And the fact that you've been vetted already by police departments, and certainly that could be very, very valuable. Sarah and I, for the audience, are engaging with the Garda, with the Irish National Police, on a similar effort that they are trying to do with their National Health Service. And Sarah and I have been engaged in conversations, and you'll hear from Inspector Andrew Lacey soon on this show to tell a little bit about it. So, Sarah, I want to thank you for your time, your energy. I wish you the best in what you're doing. You know that I'm always here for you, but thank you. Last question. If you had the chance to talk with anybody alive or dead that is renowned, not necessarily famous, who might that be?
Winston Churchill.
Really? Is that because you're...
It seems so obvious. It's not just because I'm British. And ironically, I have come to understand and study Winston Churchill in my later years and had no real concept of him while I was actually in the UK. Remember, I was a teenager, a young adult. Those were not things I was thinking about in my college years. It was Oasis and raves and the Happy Mondays and, you know, going to class from time to time. So when I was in the UK, wasn't as kind of to the UK history around. I've evolved in my thinking and learning and studying leadership, which I know this podcast is largely focused on. I've been exploring and understanding great leaders, and Churchill, some of the best speeches, some of the most rallying cries that are inherently British but incredibly strong have come from him. And he had vision and, frankly, the gravitas to be sworn into office the day after Poland was invaded, I believe. So lots to learn from him that can apply to current leadership strategies. And what he taught me was to be bold. And I'd love to hear more about how he thinks I'm doing and what advice he can give me for the future.
That's terrific. Well, you've been listening to Sarah Abbott, Dr. Sarah Abbott from Massachusetts, LaSalle College, and advocates talking about mental health intervention, and jail diversion programs. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate all that you could share with us.
Thank you for your time, Steve, and thank you for inviting me here today.
Thanks, and make sure you listen to future podcast episodes on the Cop Doc Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Cop Doc Podcast with Dr. Steve Morreale. Steve is a retired law enforcement practitioner and manager turned academic and scholar from Worcester State University. Please tune into the Cop Doc Podcast for regular episodes of interviews with thought leaders in policing.